Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Dave DeForest reporting. The leaders of Ukraine, Russia, Germany, and France emerged from talks in Belarus today with a ceasefire agreement aimed at ending months of fighting in eastern Ukraine. The ceasefire is set to begin February the 15th. Russian President Vladimir Putin said the parties have managed to agree on the main issues, including the withdrawal of heavy weapons from the conflict area. All sides stressed that disagreements remain and there is more work to be done. Just over a month after the Paris terrorist attacks, European leaders are meeting to discuss a range of counterterrorism measures. Lisa Bryant takes a look.
Concern about terrorism, particularly radical Islam, has been mounting across the 28-member European Union. Graham Watson, president of the European Liberal Group, called on EU leaders to adopt a proposal by the European Commission to create a so-called radicalization network. Among items up for discussion in Brussels are proposals to create an EU-wide system to share airline passenger information and to tighten border checks on travelers. There are also calls to fight radicalization on the internet through better cooperation and communication tools to counter extremism. Lisa Bryant, Paris.
An Egyptian court released two Al Jazeera journalists today, Mohamed Fahmy and Bahir Mohamed, will face retrial February 23rd on charges of supporting the Muslim Brotherhood. Cheers and applause erupted in the Cairo courtroom as a judge set bail at $33,000 for Mohamed Fahmy and no bail for his colleague Bahir Mohamed. A third Al Jazeera journalist, Australian Peter Gresta, was freed and sent home in February. This is VOA News. Many people are reported to be dead after an explosion rocked a market in the northeastern Nigerian town of Biu. A VOA reporter says a bomb went off at about 3:20 p.m. local time Thursday. A member of Nigeria's civilian joint task force says rescue workers are evacuating both the dead and injured from the scene, adding that the casualty figure is very high. There has been no immediate claim of responsibility for the blast. The International Red Cross says its Ebola workers in Guinea are being attacked an average of 10 times per month. In a statement today, the IRC said the attacks are endangering efforts to stop the spread of the disease. Press freedom declined around the world in 2014. A new report by Reporters Without Borders shows two-thirds of the countries surveyed worsened in the last year. Victoria Machi reports.
With journalists executed in Iraq, arrested in the United States, and targeted by governments seeking to control information, media workers on every continent faced increasing threats in 2014. Reporters Without Borders U.S. Director Delphine Algon tells VOA she knew the negative statistics were coming after a bloody year.
With 66 journalists killed, with an explosion of journalists kidnapped in Syria, Iraq, Libya, Ukraine.
Violations against press freedom increased 8% since 2013, affecting the majority of the 180 countries surveyed. Finland earned the top mark for the fifth year, helping Europe and the Balkans rate best. The Middle East and North Africa are in last place. Victoria Mackey, Washington.
A candlelight vigil was held Wednesday night at a college campus in the U.S. southeastern state of North Carolina for three Muslim students shot to death in what friends and family insist was a hate crime. A neighbor, 46-year-old Craig Stephen Hicks, has been charged with first-degree murder in connection with the killings. Police believe a long simmering dispute over parking sparked the shootings. Talks between Greece and its European creditors ended Wednesday without an agreement on changes to austerity measures connected to the nation's economic bailout by Europe. The two sides were not even able to agree on a joint statement following 7 hours of negotiations between Greece's finance minister, Yanis Varoufakis, and European Eurozone finance ministers in Brussels. A South Korean court has ruled that the daughter of the chairman of Korea Airlines violated aviation safety law during an angry outburst on board an airliner. Heather Cho, a former executive and head of in-flight services at the airline, erupted in anger over the way she was served nuts. Cho was sentenced to 1 year in prison for her actions, which have become known as the Nut Rage incident. From the VOA News Center in Washington, I'm Dave DeForest.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies has condemned attacks against its volunteers in Guinea and has warned the violence also risks spreading the Ebola virus. The Red Cross reports two volunteers were seriously beaten in the town of Forokaria, Western Guinea, on Sunday.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from Red Cross headquarters in Geneva. Details coming up.
Also, the International Rescue Committee says an estimated 150,000 refugees from the violence of Nigeria's Boko Haram have sought shelter in Niger in the past week.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Kenya, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, health experts from the West African Ebola crisis met at the World Bank in Washington, D.C. today to assess the local and global response to date. David Nabarro is the special envoy on Ebola for the U.N. Secretary General. He said lessons learned from Ebola and other health threats demonstrate that when global powers try to take over local problems, they make matters worse.
Communities and their governments are at the center. There are some who argue from time to time that outbreaks that emerge at the animal and human interface and that threaten societies beyond any particular country should be treated as matters of global concern, and that the response should be one that is taken on by a supranational authority from the start. I think evidence of the last 20 years shows that that thinking is wrong, and that prevention and response to any emerging outbreak is always primarily mounted from within the communities and within the countries that are at risk.
World Bank Vice President Keith Hansen gave an example of missteps taken by the international community when they stepped in.
In this case, as we know, unsafe burials were a primary contributor to the spread of the disease. But these are great traditional rituals in these countries, and sheer sort of abstract information from the top was not going to be effective in changing these practices. It was not until communities and traditional and faith leaders were engaged in the response that we began to see the situation turn around as communities took responsibility for their own protection.
Liberia's Assistant Minister of Health spoke about the need for stronger local collaboration when international donors and foreign agencies tried to solve problems in fragile states. Tolbert Nyanzwa said all three countries that suffered the year-long epidemic were just beginning to recover from years of civil war that had decimated their health systems. Hansen said Ebola caused immense economic destruction in all three countries. The World Bank official listed more than $1 billion in grants and aid given to help the three countries. He also announced that the World Bank today okayed $15 million to provide seed for West African farmers for their April planting season.
And the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies has condemned attacks against its volunteers in Guinea, warning this risks spreading the Ebola virus. The Red Cross reports two volunteers were seriously beaten in the town of Forokaria, Western Guinea, on Sunday. Lisa Schlein reports from Red Cross headquarters in Geneva.
Attacks against Red Cross workers in Guinea are not new. There has been an average of 10 attacks per month since last March, soon after the Ebola outbreak in that country began. But this latest incident was particularly serious and scary. The Red Cross team leader for Ebola coordination and support in Geneva, Beerta Hald, has just returned from West Africa. She tells VOA the Red Cross volunteers were attacked by an angry mob while trying to provide a safe and dignified burial in the community. Hald says there is still a lot of misunderstanding about how Ebola is spread. She says some believe that volunteers spread the virus while disinfecting houses with chlorine.
All of a sudden, it runs like a bushfire where people start shouting that the Red Cross is carrying the Ebola, and then they start attacking, either verbally abusing or even throwing stones or attacking with whatever they have at hand. And we've had a few cases where cars were burned, and we've had a few Red Cross volunteers taken to hospital.
Hull says volunteers from time to time have been unable to access communities. She says this is very dangerous because people who treat ill patients or conduct burial ceremonies without any protective gear are at risk of dying from Ebola and of spreading the disease. In its latest situation report, the World Health Organization reports nearly 23,000 confirmed cases of Ebola and 9,162 deaths in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea. It says cases remain widespread in Sierra Leone but have stabilized, while Liberia continues to report a low number of new cases. However, the WHO says there's been a sharp increase of new Ebola cases in Guinea, with 65 newly confirmed compared with 39 the previous week. It says the spike has been driven mainly by transmission in the capital, Conakry, and in the western prefecture of Forakaria, where Sunday's attack occurred. Hull says she is concerned the epidemic is not under control and could flare up again.
Another concern is also that very soon the next rainy season will start, and two things is that it'll make the roads impassable for prolonged periods of time. And secondly, we also know that the virus thrives in the humid conditions.
Halt says the Red Cross is beefing up security for its volunteers. She says aid workers also are consulting more closely with communities, local authorities, and religious leaders to try to dispel myths and false rumors about the disease. She says the agency's worst fear is Ebola will become a permanent disease in West Africa if it is not brought under control. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehiz Wuhib, 12 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Health experts from the West Africa Ebola crisis met at the World Bank in Washington, D.C. today to assess the local and global response to date. And the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies has condemned attacks against its volunteers in Guinea, warning this risks spreading the Ebola virus. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
The International Rescue Committee says an estimated 150,000 refugees from the violence of Nigeria's Boko Haram have sought shelter in Niger in the past week. Thousands have also fled the violence in the town of Difa in Niger, which is near the Nigerian border. IRC's Niger Country Director Matthias Mayer says increasing attacks within Niger are deepening the crisis. He said the area is struggling to help refugees. Authorities in Niger have registered over 100,000 from both countries. Difa schools are closed and city services are shut down as civil servants have evacuated their families. Suicide bombers struck again in Difa yesterday. The only reported victims were the bombers. Both were women. Niger has declared a 15-day state of emergency in the region, and security forces are conducting house-to-house searches. Four suspects were pulled from a truck northbound for Zinder. Security officials fear that more Boko Haram fighters have infiltrated the refugee population. Families in Niger's second-largest city, Zinder, are taking in as many as 20 refugees in their homes. Others are sleeping in the city's football stadium. Many of the refugees are farming families who left crops unharvested to avoid the danger.
Youth ministers from the Commonwealth of Nations, the former British Commonwealth, have ended a meeting in Cameroon on how to prevent young people from being tempted to join terrorist organizations. The ministers agree that two of the biggest factors are massive unemployment and the failure to involve young people in decision-making processes. Moki Edwin Kinzeka has this report from the capital, Yaoundé.
The Deputy Secretary General of the Commonwealth, Deodat Maharaj, says Africa is the world's most youthful continent, with 65% of the population below the age of 35. 10 to 15 million people enter the African labor market each year. Maharaj says this is potentially dangerous for a continent that is poor and facing challenges of war, disease and terrorism.
People don't have jobs, they don't have livelihoods, they don't have education, they don't have services where they live, they may do other things. What we want to do is to provide the best possible technical perspective and analysis for a government to decide, based on national ownership, which option is the preferred option.
African youth leaders, including Namibian-born Katjitguru Pauline, says the greatest problem with Africa is that youths who constitute a majority of the population are often not listened to before policies are drafted.
One of the biggest things that is going to suppress the voice of the African youth is that there is no consultation between youth and seniors. And how do you unite people from different backgrounds, people from different cultures, people with different perspectives? You engage and you consult. Don't speculate. Don't come up with things that you think is going to benefit the African youth.
Jean-Marc Afesimbafo of Cameroon's National Youth Council says young people in Africa continue to face daunting challenges because educational systems do not give them the opportunity to develop their full potential.
We have to reform our educational system to equip the youth with the skills necessary, not to wait for jobs, but also to be able to create jobs for themselves. And so we have to move from that educational system, which is essentially based on education, when we just took over our independence, and we need to form administrators, we need to form civil servants to nurture this young nation.
Afesimbafo adds that young people have a hard time obtaining loans from financial institutions. Zambian Minister of Youth and Sports, David Musonda, says terrorism, especially the Boko Haram insurgency in Nigeria, is partly driven by chronic pervasive unemployment.
That does not give the young people the mandate to go into illegal activities. Government is concerned, the Commonwealth is concerned, the world is concerned about the youth. We have relatively a huge young population across Africa. And these are very productive, they have the energy, and to go and begin to join terrorist groups does not provide a solution to the employment challenges that we have.
The youth ministers said they can defuse the unemployment time bomb by working with the private sector and government to create safe, decent, and competitive employment opportunities. They said they will encourage multinational companies investing in Africa to use African labor. They also reiterated calls on African countries to invest in agriculture. That sector employed 70% of African youth before 1985, but doesn't attract young people today due to lack of government support. Moki Edwin Kinzeka, VOA News, Yaoundé.
The U.S. government has unveiled its strategy to fight the illegal wildlife trade. President Obama says wildlife trafficking undermines security while decimating iconic animal populations. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
Three federal agencies, the Departments of State, Interior, and Justice, have released the National Strategy for Combating Wildlife Trafficking. It comes 1 year after President Obama announced its guiding principles. In the strategy's opening letter, Mr. Obama writes that because of the actions of poachers, species like elephants and rhinos face the risk of significant decline or even extinction. He adds that well-armed, well-equipped, and well-organized networks of criminals and corrupt officials exploit porous borders and weak institutions. Jimmy L. Mandima is Director of Program Design and Partner Relations at the African Wildlife Foundation, which played a role in developing the strategy.
I consider this to be extremely commendable on the part of the U.S. government. And for us, this just means the global community would look at the U.S. as a global leader that is charting the way to deal with this big problem challenging the wildlife trafficking.
Elephant tusks and rhino horns are a big part of the poaching trade. Such items are in great demand in parts of Asia.
The wildlife that are being targeted for this illicit trade are a natural heritage mostly for Africa, but for the global community as a whole. The keystone species, elephants, rhinos, the great apes, and the carnivores, are really ecological makers in the ecosystems and habitats. So they contribute to how the ecosystems provide services and goods to the whole global community.
The U.S. strategy also raises concerns about tigers, sharks, tuna, sea turtles, exotic birds, iguanas, chameleons, and even tarantulas. Mandima says wildlife are an economic asset, driving the tourism industry in many parts of the world. The anti-poaching strategy lists three priorities. Mandima says the first is strengthening law enforcement in the U.S. itself.
The U.S. is currently the second largest global consumer of these illicit products. And a lot of that is because the ports are porous and people are able to sneak in these illicit products. So strengthening law enforcement means that there would be more technology and reinforced staff, effort to man these ports and basically be able to detect better the infiltration and entry of these illicit products.
The second part of the strategy calls for reducing demand through public awareness campaigns in the U.S. and public diplomacy abroad.
Part of it is the issue of ignorance, just not being aware of where these resources are coming from. So the awareness campaign are really to educate the public, communicate in very basic terms the source of the products they are enjoying, to simply say we are actually causing decimation of keystone species.
The third priority is building international cooperation and commitments. The African Wildlife Federation is contributing to the anti-poaching effort through its $10 million Urgent Response Fund. Mandiba says it's helping to pay for trained sniffer dogs that can detect illegal wildlife cargo. The dogs will be used at ports or airports in Kenya, Tanzania, Ethiopia, and the DRC. The AWF also pays for public service announcements in China, featuring actor Jackie Chan and basketball star Yao Ming.
Talking to each other, engaging our patriots in Asia, in Africa, and having one common voice.
Mandima says it's time that major kingpins in wildlife trafficking are prosecuted and sentenced to set an example. The U.S. National Strategy for Combating Wildlife Trafficking says the crisis must be addressed aggressively and quickly, or it will be too late. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
The UN Refugee Agency says it is calling on the EU to urgently change how it deals with dangerous Mediterranean sea crossings by migrants and refugees. The UNHCR is making the plea following Sunday's tragedy. Around 300 people died while using small rubber dinghies to try to reach the European shore from Libya. Most were from sub-Saharan Africa. Many died from hypothermia or exposure to the elements. The UN agency says Europe's Operation Triton is a woefully inadequate replacement to the rescue operation conducted earlier by Italy. It says the EU's plan focuses primarily on border surveillance. Nearly 220,000 migrants and refugees crossed the Mediterranean last year. About 3,500 people died trying to make the voyage in unsafe boats or vessels operated by smugglers.
Oh.
Well, security has tightened in Cape Town as Parliament prepares to open this evening with a State of the Nation address by President Jacob Zuma. Julius Malema, who heads the group called Economic Freedom Fighters, has told a local radio station that he plans on quizzing the president on controversial moves he says the president has yet to answer for. Reporter Pisto Molamanye of VOA's affiliate station Kaya FM is covering the parliamentary opening in Cape Town. He spoke with me about the mood there ahead of President Zuma's speech.
Access to Cape Town will soon be restricted as we go into the afternoon. Only people with the State of the Nation address accreditation will be allowed in the Parliament building. We understand that police have been deployed to various corners around the CBD, the security services, including the police, the army, and intelligence agencies, are taking no chances. And they have also declared a no-fly zone over Parliament and surrounding areas. The police have been deployed, and then we can see them throughout the town of Cape Town in their blue attire. Unfortunately, the number of officers deployed to secure the seat in Parliament has not been revealed to the personnel that are being seen all over Cape Town.
Looking ahead at President Jacob Zuma's speech that's coming up there this evening, is he expecting a hostile reception when he opens Parliament?
The president will be highly welcomed by the majority ruling party members or the members of Parliament who are the ANC. You might be aware that ANC has more than 200 members compared to the opposition parties. So most of the MPs from the opposition parties are not going to give the president a warm welcome based on the fact that they are not in good terms with the president.
Julius Malema, the head of the Economic Freedom Fighters, is expected to heavily, I guess, quiz President Zuma over this controversial $23 million or so security upgrade to his home. Is this going to overshadow other things that Zuma wants to talk about?
Absolutely. This morning, I happened to drive around in different areas of Cape Town just to go and ask people what are their expectations from the president's speech. Unfortunately, most of the people we spoke to, they were not interested in that. Their interest was to say, we want to see the drama that Julius Malema is planning to create in Parliament this evening. So indeed, Malema's threat has overshadowed the president's speech. And unfortunately, you know, this is what Julius Malema has been saying. He says he wants everything that the president will be saying, and people must know that the president must pay, and then he's going to disrupt the parliamentary proceedings this evening. We've been trying to ask you as to disruption, what do you mean? Can you be specific? Unfortunately, he said that he will be visited by 7 o'clock this evening.
That was reporter Pitso Malamane of VOA affiliate Kaya FM. He spoke with me by mobile phone from South Africa's Parliament in Cape Town.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
A message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
Malaria kills thousands of people each year, but there are some simple things you can do to protect your family. If you can, put screens in your windows. A simple screen can keep disease-carrying mosquitoes out of your home. If you go outside, wear light-colored clothing and long pants and long sleeves, especially when it is dark and mosquitoes are most active. After it rains, empty all containers of standing water. The water in just one discarded tire can become a breeding ground for thousands of mosquitoes. Make sure your home is clear of debris and anything that holds water, including discarded cans, water containers, and rubbish. empty containers that livestock drink from regularly so that mosquitoes cannot breed there.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. The UN Refugee Agency says it is calling on the EU to urgently change how it deals with dangerous Mediterranean sea crossings by migrants and refugees. And the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies has condemned attacks against its volunteers in Guinea, warning this risks spreading the Ebola virus. Coming up, we'll have music from Kenya, and in our feature segment, a time to recognize the history and achievements of African Americans on this Black History Month. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehia Swuhi, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. And happy Thursday, Sunny.
Happy Thursday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand that Cricket World Cup tops your sports report today.
Kim, the opening ceremonies for the 2015 ICC Cricket World Cup took place Thursday in Christchurch, New Zealand, and Melbourne, Australia. The 14-nation cricket extravaganza features two teams from Africa, neighbors Zimbabwe and South Africa, who will play each other in their opening match Sunday at Seddon Park in Hamilton, New Zealand. It's one of 23 games to be played in New Zealand during the Cricket World Cup. Australia, meanwhile, will host 26 games, including the final on March 29th at Melbourne Cricket Ground. Christchurch will host the opening match Saturday between New Zealand and Sri Lanka. It will be an especially emotional day for Christchurch after the city missed out on hosting matches at the 2011 Rugby World Cup following devastating earthquakes. New Zealand Prime Minister John Key had this to say during Thursday's festivities.
The Christchurch earthquakes robbed this city of a chance to be part of the Rugby World Cup. So it's only fitting that the Cricket World Cup would have its official opening and its first match here in Christchurch. And I know that's a special way of showing the world that Christchurch is back in business.
Back in business. Meanwhile, Melbourne's opening ceremony on Thursday featured music and dance from around the world, and ICC board member Wally Edwards, a former Australian cricket player, unveiled the trophy.
And on behalf of the ICC, I am proud to unveil the ICC World Cup. It's now 2 days to go. May the best team win.
May the best team win. Yes, indeed. ICC board member Wally Edwards speaking from Melbourne, Australia. India is the defending Cricket World Cup champion. Playing at home in Mumbai, India defeated Sri Lanka by 6 wickets in the 2011 final. This is the 11th Cricket World Cup. Australia has the proudest pedigree with 4 world titles, with its last in 2007. India and the West Indies are next with 2 world titles each. Pakistan and Sri Lanka have 1 world title each. South Africa has made it to the semifinals 3 times, with its last appearance in the Final Four in 2007. Zimbabwe's best showing at the Cricket World Cup was making it to the Super 6 stage in 1999 and 2003. Zimbabwe warmed up for the big tournament with a victory Wednesday over Sri Lanka. Muziwetu Hadebe is a Zimbabwe sports commentator in a phone interview with VOA. Muziwetu said the friendly win over Sri Lanka has to be kept in perspective.
Obviously, many people did not expect them to be achieving what they've achieved, but I think they will be telling themselves that these are just warm-up games. They need to take that form into the competitive side when the tournament finally gets underway. It could be some motivation coming in with the new coach at times. Such things do motivate and change teams. We certainly hope it's something along those lines. But to do well against the likes of New Zealand, also to try and hold their own against Sri Lanka, is something which was good. And we hope that the team can always build from this. Obviously, there is a new coach. And when you get someone new at times, you tend to be a little bit motivated. You want to impress the new coach. But also going to the World Cup is always a rare opportunity for most of these young stars. And I think they would want to shine. They know that if they go out there, perform very well, who knows, they might be getting contracts even outside Zimbabwe, which are much better than what they are currently getting here in Zim. So those could be contributing factors to the fine start in terms of the warm-up matches by the Chevrons. But also we need to put into mind that the leadership has brought in new ideas. They are trying to bring in new people, are trying as well to attract the corporate world to go back into cricket. The youngsters know that with these new ideas that are coming up, they want to be a part of that new developmental strategy that is happening. It's always good to just start off with it and be part of it.
That's Zimbabwe sports commentator Muziwetu Hadebe. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and you're listening to the sunny side of sports on The Voice of America.
Friends, we can all listen to the sunny side of sports.
Yes, my friend.
Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side of life. It will help us every day. It will brighten all the way. It will keep on the sunny side of life.
Voice of America. VOA. Washington.
Hi, I'm Segun Adeyemi, coming to you all the way from Lagos, Nigeria. Weekends are for sports. Nightline Africa Sports, that is. And every Sunday, I'll give you highlights of the top sports stories of the past week and the weekend. Nightline Africa Sports from the Voice of America. Let the games begin.
We got the game on.
The National Basketball Association will celebrate its best players this weekend in New York City, where the league will hold its annual All-Star Game. Sunday's contest will be held at Madison Square Garden, the home arena of the NBA's New York Knicks Club. As part of the NBA's All-Star Weekend, there will also be activities and skills competitions at Barclays Center, the home arena of the Brooklyn Nets Club. Let's take a quick look at a few of the players in the NBA All-Star Game. James Harden of the Houston Rockets, the NBA's leading scorer at more than 27 points per game, will be suiting up for the Western Conference All-Stars, along with Spanish center Mark Gasol of the Memphis Grizzlies. Now, Mark's brother, Pau, who plays for the Chicago Bulls, will be a starter for the Eastern Conference All-Stars, along with one of my favorite players, guard John Wall of the Washington Wizards. I like to call him Wall Star of the Washington Wizards. Yes, indeed. Another guard, Stephen Curry of the Golden State Warriors, was the leading vote-getter in the fan balloting for the All-Star Game with more than 1,500,000 votes. Curry's teammate on the Warriors, Klay Thompson, will also play in the game. The Warriors have the NBA's best record at 42 wins and 9 losses. The Atlanta Hawks, who have the NBA's second best record, have 4 players selected for the All-Star game: Al Horford, Paul Millsap, Jeff Teague, and Kyle Korver. Korver is one of the NBA's best long-distance shooters, and he'll participate in this weekend's three-point shooting contest. James Harden, Stephon Curry, and Klay Thompson, who I mentioned earlier, will also participate in that contest. Just ahead, my VOA colleague James Buddy will have a Black History Month segment on a basketball Hall of Famer who won 11 NBA titles and was selected for the All-Star Game 12 consecutive times.
On this day in 1934, retired American professional basketball player William Felton Bill Russell was born in West Monroe, Louisiana. He played for the Boston Celtics of the National Basketball Association, NBA, from 1956 to 1969. A 5-time NBA Most Valuable Player, Russell was the centerpiece of the Celtics dynasty, winning 11 NBA championships during his 13-year career.
More basketball news now on the VOA as we look forward to Sunday's NBA All-Star Game. I want to give a quick shout-out for one of Kim Lewis's favorite players, Kobe Bryant. Kobe initially was selected for the All-Star Game on Sunday at Madison Square Garden. This would have been Kobe's 17th appearance in the All-Star Game. Incredible. But unfortunately, Kobe suffered a shoulder injury, and he's going to miss the rest of the season, so he will not play on Sunday. Going to give some more shout-outs for other players in the game who have been around a while. Tim Duncan of the defending champion San Antonio Spurs, he'll be making his 15th All-Star Game appearance. Dirk Nowitzki, the German star for the Dallas Mavericks, making his 13th All-Star Game appearance. LeBron James of the red-hot Cleveland Cavaliers, who have won 14 of their past 15 games. LeBron will be making his 11th All-Star Game appearance, as well as his former teammate on the Miami Heat, Dwayne Wade, also making his 11th appearance. Lots of basketball talent in New York City this weekend. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahya Wahib and Kim Lewis.
Well, get well soon, Kobe. And thanks, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, time to recognize the history and achievements of African Americans during this Black History Month. And next, the plight of Zimbabwean refugees in South Africa. But first, some music. Here is Nathaniel Nyagol of Kenya with Africa.
Continent of unity, peace, love, happiness, come see Africa, come see the beautiful land, come see Africa. Welcome to the beautiful land. Come see
Come see the beautiful. Come see the beautiful land. Come see Africa. Welcome to the beautiful land. Come see the beautiful. Come see the beautiful. Come see the beautiful land. Africa, the homeland of the animals, the birds nesting on the trees, singing, it is farming time, singing, it is harvest time, Africa. Come see Africa.
Nathaniel Niagol of Kenya with Africa.
Well, Clifton Tolbert is an African-American businessman and author of 13 books about the history of segregation in the Mississippi Delta. They include such bestsellers as Once Upon a Time When We Were Colored. Tolbert has lectured to the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, the airplane manufacturer, Lockheed Martin, the Bank of America, the U.S. Department of Justice, and classes at Harvard University and the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business. In part one of a two-part interview, reporter William Eagle spoke to Mr. Tolbert about his life and philosophy. He says while segregation was an assault on African-American equality and freedom, it did encourage self-reliance and strong values among black communities.
As I look back and recall my life growing up during the era of legal segregation, there's no doubt in my mind that opportunities were few and barriers were everywhere. But there was also something else there, what I call that survival instinct, that tremendous sense of community, where the elders within our community had vision for their children and the next generation. It was as if unselfishness was unleashed in such a way that they gave us reason to believe that we could face tomorrow, and tomorrow would be better as a result of that.
Some historians have said that segregation, of course, limited black businessmen and entrepreneurs. The good thing was that it forced the community to rely on its own resources, and in fact, black businesses flourished, as did schools and education, whereas with the end of segregation, it was open to more competition, and some of that broke down. Some businesses went under, faced with larger competition, white businesses, for example.
Well, you know, it's interesting when I think about the harshness of legal segregation. I see that as a surrounding barriers. And so it would seem that pressure would have been so strong and so overwhelming that one would not have had the opportunity to think for a better life for themselves. But what I find to be interesting, that even in the 200 or so years of slavery, once slavery was over, there was this incredible move toward self-sufficiency. There was this incredible move toward education. Even though color was a divisive boundary that still existed, but within that divisive boundary, the mindset of African Americans were, we are going to make this thing happen for us. But of course, when integration came, the idea that you could stretch your wings further and make even greater contributions, that did begin to happen, but in so doing, I think that it also gave way to the breakdown in the solidarity that many of us had experienced during those years of legal segregation.
There's always been in the African-American community those who favored education and individual progress versus class action and legal remedies. This was particularly 100 years ago, the turn of the century, around the 1900s. Did you witness that in your childhood, and what are your views today?
You know, I think life is incredibly complex, and I'm not sure there are either ors in that very dynamic sphere that we're speaking of how to go about bringing about the equality of effort, the equality of education, how to go about giving everybody a seat at the tables, but at the same time allowing them to maximize their potential and be very, let's say, really excited about their potential being maximized. You know, I think that as in every area of our lives, there will be certain processes that work best during a certain period of time, and then there are other processes that you build upon. I mean, there was a time in America that had we not marched, I doubted we would be having this conversation today. But does that mean we still march today, or does that mean that we look at what marching has accomplished, and now we look for what is the next level that we need to embrace as Americans, all of us together, moving us toward that spot of equity that our documents allude to?
Today, the Supreme Court is modifying some of the measures or protections put in place to protect voting rights, particularly in those states that had a history of voter discrimination. Supporters say it's part of an effort to make the law, quote-unquote, colorblind. What's your reaction to that?
You know, I have multiple reactions, because the one thing that I don't know as these laws are being enacted, I don't have the privilege of being able to sit at the table with a couple of people who may be powerful and influential. I'm not sure what's driving them. I hear what they say, but I'm not quite sure at this point in my life of the motivation that drives them. You know, I'm not sure that we've had these things in place long enough to really reach for them to have reached their full potential. I would rather err on the side of having them longer than not having them long enough.
That was author Clifton Tolbert speaking with reporter William Eagle. Tomorrow, Tolbert talks about some of the values from segregation to improve business management.
The South African government denies reports it will deport Zimbabweans who did not reapply for special dispensation permits. The deadline to legally stay was December 31st. An estimated 210,000 applied, but Mehilomi Shiwiti of the South African Home Affairs Department says they want to find out why 35,000 did not apply. Shiwiti tells reporter Tatenda Gumbo they are completing registration for all Zimbabweans who signed up.
We are still going to tally up and try and find out what happened to most of the people. But what we do know is that a good number of them have moved from the ZSP to ordinary work permits. It's important to understand what the ZSP is. ZSP was done in 2010 for people who were in the country illegally, and it was done to try to regularize their stay. It wasn't the complete sum of Zimbabwean foreign nationals in South Africa, and it doesn't represent all Zimbabwean nationals in South Africa. It was specifically for those people who were in the country illegally. So some of those people may have moved from the ZSP to an ordinary work permit. I have spoken to a number of people who have done that. To the extent that deportations will happen, they will happen if anybody's undocumented, whether they're Zimbabwean or American. It's not an intention to target Zimbabwean nationals. Everybody should be documented, and that applies in America and Europe too.
How will you be tallying to find out if some people have moved
on?
We
have the department took details of those people who had received the old special dispensation. They took details of those people. So we intend to do a survey to see what happened to them.
And looking at the new ZSP process, there are some who are already receiving their permits who reapplied. May you explain how exactly someone will regularize their stay in anticipation of the permit's expiration?
The same way it applies for anybody else. You apply for a certain work permit. When you apply for that work permit, it's clarified to you what you need to do. And in many of those cases, you apply from the country of origin. You are adjudicated, and then you are given a response by the department.
So you're saying that for the Zimbabweans, even if they are under the ZSP, they will have to follow the similar law like anyone else?
Well, for the most part, we try to apply our law as equally as possible. What we expect of other foreign nationals is expect of the rest. We try to apply ourselves equally as possible.
South African Home Affairs spokesman Mihilomi Shiwiti speaking from Johannesburg with reporter Tatenda Gumbo. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Audrey Swigas, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On February 3rd, ISIL released a video showing its execution of Royal Jordanian Air Force pilot Moaz al-Qassasbeh by burning him alive in a cage. In the wake of his brutal murder, President Barack Obama said in a statement that Captain al-Qassasbeh's dedication, courage, and service to his country and family represent universal human values that stand in opposition to the cowardice and depravity of ISIL, which has been so broadly rejected around the globe. In televised remarks, President Obama also said that this is one more example of the viciousness and barbarity of this organization. And he said, "I think it will redouble the vigilance and determination on the part of the global coalition to make sure that they are degraded and ultimately defeated." The execution of Captain al-Qassasbeh is ISIL's third highly publicized murder of hostages since the start of 2015. In January, ISIL released videos of the beheadings of Japanese citizens Haruna Yukawa and Kenji Goto. Secretary of State John Kerry condemned the murders of the Japanese men, saying in a statement that their barbaric killing shows again ISIL's brutality and extremist agenda. The United States, he said, will continue to stand shoulder to shoulder with Japan in confronting terrorism. In an interview with CNN's Fareed Zakaria, President Obama predicted that terrorist groups like ISIL will ultimately be defeated, not only because of the efforts of the global coalition that has rallied against it, but because they don't have a vision that appeals to ordinary people. It is, as it has been described in some cases, a death cult or an entirely backward-looking fantasy that can't function in the world. When you look at ISIL, it has no governing strategy. It can talk about setting up the new caliphate, but nobody is under any illusions that they can actually, in a sustained way, feed people or educate people or organize a society that would work. Mr. Obama emphasized that the conflict with ISIL is not a religious war, because the overwhelming majority of Muslims reject ISIL's interpretation of Islam. They don't even recognize it as being Islam, he said. For us to be successful in fighting this scourge, it's very important for us to align ourselves with the 99.9% of Muslims who are looking for the same thing we're looking for: order, peace, and prosperity.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Hello, I'm Douglas Impuga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC